You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show. TAS is a show for everyone where we try to get behind the headlines and the articles and present archaeology to the public in a fun and interesting way. I'm doing an in-person interview today, so April can't join me today because we haven't really got a solid way to do that just yet, where we've got somebody in the studio and then we bring somebody in through Skype, but I'm working on it, so that'll be soon. My guest today is, we actually met here in Reno when her business partner was presenting their business that sells vintage reproduction shoes that we're going to talk about later. The business is called Royal Vintage Shoes, and you can find links in the show notes. That's the one they presented on, but we'll talk about all that later. Abby Cox has a BA from Indiana University at Bloomington in art history and history, as well as minors in theater and drama with a focus on acting and costume design, and a master of letters in decorative arts and design history from the University of Glasgow in Scotland. She's worked at Colonial Williamsburg as an apprentice milliner and mantua maker, which we'll talk about. Today, Abby is the vice president of American Duchess and Royal Vintage Shoes, where they reproduce, as I mentioned before, historically accurate women's shoes. So, welcome to the show, Abby.
Hi. I'm super
after that
excited
long introduction.
I feel really embarrassed now.
No. All right. So first, let's just talk about, we're going to get into some of that stuff that we mentioned in your introduction, but what started you off onto this? How did you get interested in this whole line of clothing and vintage clothing and stuff?
That's a good question. I think the best answer for that is the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My mother was actually a history major. She has her master's in history. She used to work at, historic homes back where I'm from, which is in Louisville, Kentucky. And so I grew up with going to historic homes and places and even just like, you know, little dinky Renaissance fairs in the 80s. And I've always liked dressing up. I've always liked acting and pretending to be someone else. And I've always enjoyed the costuming aspect of theater and production. I've always liked putting on the costume and becoming somebody else. And so that's always been there inside of me. I just have been that way. And when I was in college, I took costuming 101 as a part of just my theater degree before I had switched over to art history. And my professor, Linda Pisano, she just lit this fire in me. And I realized that you could actually study historic clothing as an actual field of study. It never occurred to me. And even back in the early 2000s when I was in university, it wasn't really a thing. Nowadays, mm-hmm. It's a huge thing. Like everyone, I want to major in dress history. I want to major in dress history. I'm like,
dress history, is that a thing?
Yeah. Like you whippersnappers here with your benefit of being able to actually get a degree in this. What is this nonsense? But nice. So I ended up going into art history so I could look at paintings and art and study clothing through that way, which was very useful when it came to dating stuff. And then continuing to learn as much about sewing and construction as I could from the costuming department at Indiana. And so I just kind of got this wild hair at my butt about doing this thing. And I did an internship at Colonial Williamsburg when I was in undergrad. I spent one day a week with the curator there of costume and textiles, Linda Baumgarten, beg your pardon. A lot of Lindas in my life. Mm-hmm. And then the other 4 days a week were spent at the millinery shop. And that's when it all started to make sense to me.
Yeah.
But I knew that I didn't want to just go immediately into work. I graduated my undergrad in 2008. We all know what happened around 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
It was great. So, woo, I'm that millennial.
Yeah.
And I knew that how competitive the museum world was, that if I wanted to get a job working with clothing and textiles, historic pieces, I had to be really qualified. I had to have something that made me special. And so I just went ahead and got my master's degree right away.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, if I could have taken some time off in between, I think that would have served me better.
Right.
But I knew that why would a, 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid who just got her bachelor's degree in a terrible economy get a job, So I was like, no, it's not going to happen that way. I need to go off and get my master's, which was great because then I got to go to Scotland and Europe and I got to study clothes there. And my degree program was all decorative arts. So clothing was included with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also furniture and pottery and other things that I actually didn't care about. I was like, this is boring, but oh well, I have to do it to be able to look at clothes.
Yeah.
So I made it work for myself at that point in time. Now it's a lot easier, like I said, for everybody. And then I ended up living in Sweden for a while, which is completely beside the point, before I ended up back at Colonial Williamsburg. Nice. And working there. And then
Sweden's awesome.
Yeah. It's very cold and dark there too.
I love it.
but I ended up working, at Colonial Williamsburg for about 5.5 years, almost 6 years. And then, the last chunk of that time was spent working as the apprentice milliner mantua maker. So,
and what really is a mantua maker?
A mantua maker is an 18th century dressmaker.
Okay.
So it's just a really old word for that.
Yeah.
You see it up through the mid 19th century, but by basically 1850s, it's switched over to dressmaker.
Okay.
It's just a really old.
So those people who identified as mantua makers, I mean, that's all they did was dresses? They didn't do anything else?
Yeah. Mantua making, I mean, I think this is what's really interesting about industry in the past and going into like the 18th century is that you could really specialize yourself into one very like specific skill set and you could get really good at it and you can make a good living doing it. Now, so there are plenty of women who are just mantua makers and that's its own apprenticeship. That's its own process. For women, though, in the 18th century, when they're trying to make a living for themselves and they're doing this industry because mantua making and millinery are female dominated trades in the 18th century, very often they did actually do two apprenticeships. So they would do mantua making, which is dressmaking, and then they would go into millinery, which if anyone here is listening who's aware of the word millinery, they're probably instantly thinking of hats, but it's more than hats in the 18th century. It's accessories. So all the bits and pieces that go with your outfit. Right. So they do actually go hand in hand really well together. And then when you're doing more research, which kind of leads into the pile of stuff that's on the table here, to continue to make yourself marketable and desirable as a businesswoman, they would continue to expand. So you'd see like fine laundering, you know, perfumes, stuff like that. But you'd also see hairdressing and hairdressing products and being able to do that as well. And that's kind of one of those weird avenues that I ended up going down was hairdressing and the hair products. And so I went down that avenue when I was in my apprenticeship to figure out how they actually took care of hair in the 18th century and how you could dress hair in the 18th century or fix hair for women.
Right.
And it was all interconnected. So if you were a good businesswoman in the 18th century, you did more than one thing. But yeah, mantua making is dressmaking.
Okay.
That's a long-winded answer.
No, it's good because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this that have little idea about how, I mean, how intricate this stuff was and some of the older terms and stuff, which leads me into asking, how did you, because you talk a lot about 18th century clothing and we'll mention a book later that you've got out and things like that. So what made you decide on this time period in particular? Like what fascinates you about this time period? And also, I mean, you were in Scotland, but you also worked in Colonial Williamsburg. I mean, how different at that time period were those things?
I think it depends on what part of Scotland you were in at that point in time.
Like Highlands are probably different than Edinburgh or Glasgow.
Yeah. Glasgow being pretty industrial. Edinburgh, of course, like the new town in Edinburgh is just gorgeous 18th century building. So a lot more money and wealth, a lot more fashion. And for a lot of costumers and living historians and reenactors, and for women especially, I feel like when you get bit by the bug, it's usually one of three time periods. It's either the 18th century around the Revolutionary War, or it's the War of 1812 and Jane Austen, or it's the Civil War. I just loved the silhouettes of the 18th century. I thought it was beautiful. I thought the women looked stunning. I love the clothes. I love the shapes. I love how women looked at that point in time in history. It just really spoke to me in a way that the Civil War era, the 1860s, doesn't.
Right.
Like, even today, I'm kind of like, bleh. the, you know, War of 1812 and Jane Austen, I'm appreciating that time period more. But but for whatever reason, and there's a lot of people who are like this, just the 1700s, especially the late 1700s, the 1770s and 1780s, it's just one of those time periods that you put it on, it doesn't really matter what your body shape is, or how tall you are, or how thin you are, or how voluptuous you are. You just look good. You look really good. And it's nice. Very flattering. And so it makes you feel good about yourself. And I just fell in love with it.
Nice. Yeah. Do you know if there's a catalyst to all that? Like, was there a person, a particular like royal person or something like that, that like popularized a style that everybody just embraced? Or
are you talking about as a reenactor or a costumer, or as like historical?
Well, figures? As like the late 1700s, mm-hmm. where I guess this style of dress that you're talking mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. Like clearly you're not talking about the mid or early 1700s or later in the 1800s.
<Very specific>.
So did somebody design something that just like took the world by storm, yeah. or like what changed to make this so popular?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you want to talk about fashionable figures in the 18th century, it depends on where you're located. But obviously mm-hmm. Marie Antoinette gets a lot of credit in France for being, because she's the queen and it's her job to set fashion and move it forward. France's industry was luxury goods and fashion goods. Mm-hmm. They need fashion to move, to keep their industry going.
Right.
In England, the Duchess of Devonshire is credited a lot with setting fashions and trends and things like that. But you also see famous actresses and just women of the town that are just known as being very fashionable women. And here in America, in the colonies, you know, we were about 4 to 8 weeks behind, but we were very wealthy over here. There was a lot of money in America in the 18th century. And so they would have, whether it's a fellow milliner or a mantua maker communicating information to other business partners over here, or if it's a cousin or a friend that's saying, oh, this is what's going on. This is what we're seeing. This so-and-so mm-hmm. is wearing this, or just the newspapers trickling down. Because, I mean, you go through the 18th century newspapers, it's like so-and-so wore this and so-and-so wore that. And oh my gosh, this looks terrible. What are they thinking? This looks this is awful. And then it just gets transferred down to the Americas and trying to follow it as best as we could, given the differences in climate and stuff like that.
So from a historical standpoint and kind of an experimental archaeology standpoint, mm-hmm. What are the tools you can use to recreate some of this stuff? Like, what kind of mm-hmm. information do we have about the past that's most helpful to you for that?
We have a lot of inventories.
Oh. So like actual dresses?
Yeah, we have a ton. There's actually a nice selection of originals.
Nice.
That you can find in museums all over the place. In fact, here in Nevada, there's an 18th century dress.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was modified in the 19th century to be a masquerade costume, which is really common. But there's 18th century clothes survive. I'm not really sure. I can't really give you exactly why, but mm-hmm. I have my theories that the reason 18th century clothes seem to survive better than other centuries or other decades is how the fabric was treated. At this point in time, we don't have artificial chemical dyes like arsenic dye or like the mauve color. It's still all plant-based dyes mm-hmm. or natural dyes. The way the materials were woven was still all by hand. And so it's a really strong textile that seems to be created in the 18th century.
Okay.
And the way that they were sewn helps protect the fabric as well, because it's all hand sewn. We don't have sewing machines yet.
Right.
And I think all of this kind of combined has led to a nice selection of original pieces surviving in museums and in private collections. And so, yeah, I've gone through a lot of collections, actually. Mm. Not as much as I would like to, but I've been through a nice selection. And just studying the originals, seeing how they're put together, and then trying to take that information and then recreate it.
Yeah.
The biggest challenge for us as modern people trying to recreate 18th century dress, and this goes for honestly anything pre-1960, the textiles are not the same. The fabrics are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot more fabric to pick from with different material choices, but when it comes to working with natural fiber textiles, forget about it.
Right.
It's really difficult. So even just finding a good silk taffeta can be really challenging. Hmm. Forget about actually getting it and then the period correct width,
right?
Because they were woven much more narrow in the 18th century, silk was.
Okay.
You know, so if you buy silk today, it's usually between, I think I've seen as narrow as 36 inches wide,
mm-hmm.
but all the way up to 60 inches wide. They didn't have silk that wide in the 18th century.
Hmm.
Or getting good quality linen. Oh my gosh, that's a whole tangent altogether is how bad the linen is today. You know, things like Stroud, which is a type of woolen fabric, we don't really have Stroud anymore.
Hmm.
and good quality broadcloths and things like that. It's the quality of natural fiber fabrics has gone down just so fast since, you know, the 1950s, 1960s. And so that's really challenging, because if you want to recreate something correctly and then you say, okay, well, they had fustian here. Well, can you actually even get fustian? It's like, it doesn't really exist anymore. Yeah. Sometimes people can find something that's really close, which is it's a mixed fiber.
Oh, okay.
That's used in men's clothing usually. Sorry, that's like a super random word that I threw out there.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you what it means.
And it's, you know, it doesn't really exist. Or Nanking cotton, which is a type of cotton that was grown in China that's a kind of goldy, orangey, brownish color. You can't really get Nanking cotton today. I think people have found the plant and been able to say this is what the flower essentially looks like. Yeah. But to buy Nanking cotton,
nobody's really making it.
No, they're not making it. You dye it as close as you can to make it look like Nanking color, but it's not Nanking cotton.
Hmm. So it was like an orange cotton, like naturally?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
It's like this weird, like orangey brownish. It's really hard to explain the color.
Yeah.
Nice. Cotton, yeah.
Well, that's really neat. So
it's,
what about...
It's challenging.
So there's actual dresses that survive, which is handy. Did they use? I know. Now, my wife does some sewing, so I see her like with these patterns spread out all over the house sometimes where she's cutting things up. Did they use patterns back then? And did anything like that survive?
So yes and no.
Yeah.
Tailors in the past used patterns, paper shapes. When it comes to the millinery trade, you see patterns being used as well, paper shapes. This is where it gets really tricky. The traditional thought process with mantua making is that they didn't use paper shapes. They cut and fit to the body of the wearer. So it's a very customized fit. It's a very hands-on experience, literally. With that being said, it's a never say never situation with the 18th century. There are a French Diderot has like cutting diagrams on how to cut out a gown pattern essentially in the tailor's way using measurement and things like that. So there is some evidence that you could definitely do it with paper patterns. Were there commercial patterns that you could purchase to make your clothes at home? Absolutely not.
Right, of course.
Absolutely not. No, because that's shooting yourself in the foot when it comes to you as a tailor or a mantua maker or anybody like that. Mm-hmm. You want to keep that information secret and private because it protects you.
What about like, poor families and things like that? I mean, they couldn't maybe go to a tailor. Do they just make their own?
No, they still. That's a common misconception. I think about it this way, right? If you are poor, you are so occupied with feeding yourself.
It's a true story.
You don't really have time to do anything else.
Yeah.
Your whole world is food. So whether you're growing the food or cooking the food, preserving the food, it's food, 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 food.
Right.
Which sounds kind of amazing. And if you're a foodie, I don't want to go live at that point in time and be a poor person.
Right.
Sounds awful. So you don't have the time.
Right.
You don't have the artificial light to sew at night. A lot of people go, oh, they sewed by the fire. It's like, have you all ever tried to sew?
Yeah.
Using only candlelight or firelight? It doesn't work. It's not a steady bright light. You can't see. You start looking at your stitches the next day, it's going to be a mess.
Right.
So you have to sew by daylight. Labor is very cheap in the 18th century. The material is what is expensive. So if you can only go to town maybe twice a year or four times a year, if you can buy the fabric, you can throw a few more shillings at the person to have them make something up for you really quickly.
Right.
We could also go into the whole concept of secondhand clothing in the 18th century and that there was an industry there, especially in larger cities like in London and Paris. Yeah. Not so much here in the colonies because, like I said, we were actually much more wealthier than what people, I think, realize.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could afford the fabric, you could afford to have someone make something for you.
Right.
It's really fast to make work clothes. They're not complicated. They're not elaborate. They're not the ones that survive in museums. What we see in museums are these beautiful pieces of fashion, essentially. Yeah. But your work clothes, it's essentially like a woman's bedgown is a long piece of fabric that can be folded in half so there's no shoulder seams. And you cut the sleeves out kimono style, so it's all cut in one. And it's just, you know, jack into the slit up the middle.
Yeah.
It takes like 6 hours to make.
Wow.
It's super fast. And so if you're working out in the country, you're not going to necessarily be wearing overly fitted clothing. You're going to need more bedgowns and little jackets like that to work right. versus, you know, something a little bit nicer. But you would have still fitted gowns as well. It's just, what do you need to survive in your life effectively?
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's going to do it for this segment. We're going to take a short break and come back. And I think we'll talk all about hair just because I can't stop looking at the stuff on the table here. Back in a second.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Okay, we're back, and I'm talking with Abby Cox about about recreating vintage things. We mainly talked in the first segment about 18th century dresses and things, but one of the things you kind of derailed yourself in your research studies was into hair.
Yes.
And you really got into studying that. So
I
let's talk about hair and what fascinates you about hair.
I love talking about hair. It's my favorite thing.
Nice. So what was hair care like in the time when we were, you know, putting refuse in pots and dumping it out the window and only showered once every week
Declarations of Independence and having fun like that.
Right.
Mischief and mayhem, throwing tea over ships.
That's right.
So yeah, 18th century hair care is basically the complete opposite of modern hair care. That's the most generalized way to explain it. So in the 18th century, if we think about what that environment's like, where we're living, things like that. You know, we don't have electricity. We don't have running water. You know, the temperature, depending on what country you're in or what location you're in, is going to be, you know, cold and damp. It is technically the mini ice age. Mm-hmm. You know, or if you're living in, you know, the Caribbean or the Southern American colonies, it can be very hot and damp.
Right.
And very tropical in its environment. So we're living in a world where you don't submerge your body in water on a regular basis or bathe.
Mm-hmm.
You are washing every day. You have your wash basin, you have your soap, you have your water. You wash your face, hands, feet, smelly bits, things like that, because you want to be clean and hygienic. It is very valuable, and it's important in the 18th century to be hygienic. The way they view hygiene is a little different than how we view hygiene, because they just don't understand germs and bacteria the same way we do. They just don't have that information yet. They're still coming out of the really old, like, humors and stuff like that mentality in Western medicine, and starting to be like, so here's a microscope, you know,
just learning about germs and things.
Yeah. So let's look at a flea and whatnot. But they understand that cleanliness is important, and you need to be clean. So the way they took care of their hair is different. The most common way you take care of your hair in the 18th century, especially the late 18th century, and this is including, and when I talk about this, I'm focusing mostly on Anglo-American women, with French women as well, kind of on the side.
Is this different from men at the time as well?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I don't feel comfortable talking about men's hair or hairstyles as much as I do with women's, because I haven't gone down that research path.
Yeah.
And I feel like in this particular case, especially with hair, gender is actually really important.
It's different enough. Yeah.
It's different enough.
Okay.
Because one thing's a myth for women, it's not necessarily a myth for men.
Oh, gotcha.
Like wigs.
It's good to know.
So that's why I usually like to really try and clarify everything.
Okay.
And also that if you lump and just say women in the 18th century, it's like, well, are you talking about English women? Are you talking about French women? Are you talking about German women, Scandinavian women? Are you talking about Eastern European women? Are you talking about American women? Are you talking about women in the Caribbean? Are you talking about women in India? Like, where are we going here? Right.
Yeah.
So I try to keep it as clear as possible, as best as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So hair care in the 18th century, it was, like I said, important to be hygienic. But washing your hair was not a thing. like we do it today.
Right.
And in fact, we wash our hair too much today.
Yeah.
Now we have all this information coming out going, don't wash your hair every day. That's bad for your hair. Wash it like once a week or twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have these whole no poo movements, these no shampoo movements, people washing their hair with vinegar and baking soda or new hair products coming out saying, you know, it's sulfate free. It's PEG free. It's, you know, all of this free, free, free. It's supernatural, really good for your hair, healthy for your hair. Now it's like, don't use conditioner. It's bad for you. And just all this stuff, right? So in the 18th century, they didn't wash their hair like we do today.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they used a series of pomade or pomatum in English and then powder combined to keep the hair clean and healthy. Pomade is an animal fat based product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually pig's fat, lard, but you see mixtures of different type of animal fat. So like I've seen chicken, I've seen beef, pig, obviously. And my favorite actually to mix with pig's lard is mutton tallow.
Oh.
Sheep's fat.
Okay.
So I've seen like different like mixes
of
the animal fats. So you put that on your hair and then you put the powder on your hair over top of the pomade to like soak up the excess moisture and grease.
Okay.
And then that creates clean hair.
Hmm.
Now, is it going to be shiny? Like we because we think when we, you know, we look at hair and we go... Shiny hair is healthy. You know, think of all those like commercials and the woman's hair is like flowing and it's like shiny and bouncy and beautiful. It's
wait, women's hair flowing back and forth? That's not natural?
No,
wait, no.
It's not natural.
Oh, okay.
at all. but like shiny hair is not associated with clean hair in the 18th century. So it would, it would, could be powdered all the way up to like a well, depending on what your natural hair color is, like gray or white.
Mm-hmm.
But if you comb it out enough, it actually just kind of becomes a fairly lighter, mattified version of your own natural hair color if you're not heavy on the powder.
Right.
And that's how you kept it clean and like combing it on a regular basis.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that would be heavy almost.
No, it's
great.
There.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it is heavier because you're putting, because powder, hair powder is starch-based.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're putting starch with fat,
yeah,
moisture, it's going to expand, right? So it does expand around the hair, your individual hair. And that's actually really awesome if you have really fine hair or thin hair. So it makes your hair all of a sudden like super thick and has all this great texture to it. And so it's great. Like I loved having pomade and powdered hair because I have really fine hair and it's really flat if I don't put a lot of product in it and to build it up and to give a body and texture. And so the 18th century pomade and powder, it did that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's like I would have it's like this big mane of hair and it's like, I've never had this before. And then I did actually feel like I was in a hair shampoo commercial.
Nice.
And I would like walk around like flipping my hair everywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really cool to have all of this texture added to your hair and all this volume that I never experienced before in my life ever. So it could be considered, I guess, heavy, especially if you had super duper long hair, but it's pretty awesome.
Nice.
To be frank, I loved it.
So like we talked about with the dresses and how you recreate that stuff. I mean, you had actual dresses and some things to go from. So how do you research hair products? Because you can't really tell from paintings and things. So
the challenge with this was, there was a twofold challenge here. Recreating the hair products. So the pomade and powders, that's actually, it's challenging, but not as challenging as the other aspects. Because there were so many like beauty books in the 18th century that had recipes in them and hairdressing books that just going on to like Echo 18th century collections online and just typing in hairdressing, it's just like da 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 da. I mean, even you can go to Google Books and look up Toilette de Flora and it's free and it's from 1772. And so the recipes that I used were from Toilette de Flora because that was the most easily accessible beauty book that I had access to. And it has the ingredients. It's just like a cookbook.
Wow.
But it's just with beauty products instead.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out when they use the word pomatum, are they talking about hair pomatum or skin cream or lotions? Because they use that term interchangeably. And you're like, wait, is this one for hair or is this one for your skin? which I started to assume that if it had almond oil in it, then it was for your skin.
Yeah.
So I found like a common pomatum recipe, which is what I actually brought in the little tin and I reproduced that.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually my pomatum is from a different one because the Toilette de Flora is mostly pig's fat. And I really like combining the sheep tallow and the pig's fat together. So actually my common pomatum is from a different hairdressing manual, but my hair powder is from Toilette de Florida.
Okay.
And just following the ingredients there and other hairdressing manuals. The bigger challenge is figuring out how they got the weird hair shapes and going, okay, so I look at pictures and I see this weird, tall, lots of curls, just mm-hmm. defying gravity hair styles. Is that even possible?
Right.
And that's really what started me down this path, is I was working on a program and trying to say, okay, well, can we do this without the aid of wigs?
Mm-hmm.
Because while women and wigs, okay, let me back up. While wigs existed in the 18th century, we know this, wigs were extremely common in the 18th century. How common were they actually for women versus men? And this kind of goes back to why I like to keep things separate in the gender.
Yeah.
Because men did wear wigs. That was very obvious. That was very common and always spoken about. But mm-hmm. the idea of women wearing wigs is actually not as cut and dry.
Hmm.
People just assume that they wore wigs because we go, oh, well, wigs were popular in the 18th century. People wore wigs. It's like, well, men wore wigs. Women did wear wigs if they had to. So we're talking about a health issue mostly, mm-hmm. or an age issue. And when you look at satirical prints of women where it's obvious that they're wearing a wig, usually it's because they're old or they're sick or there's something else going on there. Like right. they're making fun of the woman. It's used as a way to ridicule her.
Oh, wow.
Because hair was associated with health and beauty and vitality. And it was important for a woman to have healthy hair. It was important to have healthy hair
mm-hmm.
In the 18th century. So it's used as a tool to basically mock women,
wow.
Especially older women who are trying to be young and beautiful and trendy. Right. It's a way to make fun of them. Women used fake hair, like extensions today, like what women use today, or mm-hmm. fake hair pieces, or, you know, they'll put in fake curls or fake what's called a chignon or like a braid in the back to add that extra hair to what they already have.
Okay.
So they're still using their own hair, but they're adding to it, but not necessarily shaving their head and putting a wig on. That is something that if it was done by women, it's usually in an extreme circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we have these crazy hairstyles. We don't want to use a wig. We want to figure out how they did it in the 18th century. Is it possible to achieve these weird shapes? And that was the hardest part. And that's still the hardest part, is going, okay, well, what did they use for the cushions or the rollers? Those are the words I come across in my research underneath.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have necessarily diagrams for those. I found one in a 1780s. It wasn't by Diderot anymore. It was by the guy who kind of, I think he stole Diderot's work and then like added on to it in the 18th century. And he has one cushion and it's this really terrible line drawing. And it's just a little triangular shape,
mm-hmm.
but it's not about creating sculptural shapes by that point in the 1780s. In the 1780s, women's hair was curly and frizzy and very full to the sides.
Hmm.
So that hair shape, that hair cushion is not used in the same way that they were in like the 1770s.
Yeah.
So it was trying to figure out, how can we get these shapes with natural hair using cushions? What materials did they use?
Mm-hmm.
What was the best way to do it? That's been where a lot of the experimentation has happened, and figuring out just how to apply the pomade and powder, because I can get the recipes, but how do you put it on?
Right.
You know, how do you know when enough is too much, like too much is too much, or is it just right? Or do I need to do more?
Right.
Am I messing this up because modern human error, things like that. But
okay.
The hair cushions were the big challenge. Started off using wool because I went back to like preschool and like, you know how you had like the felt.
Yeah, yeah.
You like things and you put like felt shapes
mm-hmm.
on the, I was like, okay, so hair is hair is hair. Static electricity. If I used wool instead of like a cotton, especially a silk, then that actually should work. And so I started off using just like a really cheap woolen material, like a broadcloth, but mm-hmm. that it was too tightly woven. And then I ended up going down using wool knit.
Oh.
And that really is what changed my game. I actually don't think I have a wool knit one
okay.
Here. And then it was like, well, do I stuff it with wool roving? Wool roving worked. It's a little heavy, but it would eventually start to felt onto itself. Do I use down feathers? I love using down feathers, but there's a problem when you put down feathers into a wool knit.
Yeah.
So one of the cushions I have here, you can see like the feathers are coming out.
Poking out through it. Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, and there's definitely been times when I've worn that cushion and like someone's come up to me and like pulled a feather out of its like literal feather head.
Nice.
So just trying to figure that out. And that one's still just a process.
Yeah.
I think a lot of modern costumers and reenactors today, if they're trying to do it, trying to use cushions or rollers, I do think there's a tendency to fall back on modern materials or a modern sort of knit.
Yeah.
That and using stuffing it with hair, which you could do as well. But some of these cushions are so big that if you're actually trying to use, say, your own hair that you've collected over time, that's going to take you years and years and years. I mean, I guess you could use horse hair too. I just never had access to fake horse hair to see if that would actually work better to stuff with. So I just kind of was trying to think, what would they have access to? What could I use? How does this change? And even today, I'm still like, well, maybe I should try like ground up cork. Like maybe that would work better because it has the moldability of down feathers, but but it won't come out of my head, make me look like I'm crazy. Maybe I should try to get some horse hair, but if horse hair sticks out, that's going to itch just as bad as feathers.
Right.
So yeah, things like that.
So I don't think I fully understood when you started talking about this, but I'm getting it now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the stuff that you brought. So some of these, they look like black
pillows almost.
Yeah. But this actually physically goes into your hair. You like wrap hair around it basically. Yeah. And it's a frame almost.
So
it's crazy.
Yeah. So the words I've come across are roller and cushion.
Okay.
So for everyone listening at home who can totally look into the studio right now, the way I've interpreted the word roller is the way the word is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a roller. You're rolling something over it. And so basically a roller to me is something that looks anywhere between a rotten banana and a black hot dog.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually roll your hair over it and roll. And it sits towards the front of the hair. So men and women both would have sometimes, depending on the trend, volume at the front of their hair.
Mm-hmm.
That if you rolled your hair over it, you would have a clean finish in the back, which is important for men because they, when you look at like engravings and things and you see men from behind, usually it's a pretty clean finish in the back.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a roller, side curls, and then their hair is cued in the back. So you need to have a clean finish and it needs to be secure. So physically rolling the hair over the roller is one of the best ways to do that because the ends of the hair are now tucked up onto themselves. So it's hidden. And then you slide some hairpins in, nice clean finish. A cushion, I interpreted that fairly literally.
Yeah.
It's a cushion. The shapes of the cushion are what changes. So my like pride and joy, I guess I could say, was I call it the donut, which is the one that's closest to you.
Yeah.
It looks like a swimmy from when you're learning how to swim as a child.
Yeah, it looks like one of those armbands kind of things. Yeah, yeah, totally.
I was looking at images and engravings and fashion plates, and I was noticing that if you could see the top of the woman's hair, the way the shadowing was is that the hair was going either in or coming out of something.
Up through the middle and then
down, or it goes around and then is tucked into the hole of the donut. And then it can be pinned on the inside and secured. So again, you have a cleaner finish and you have all of this height.
Right.
That I think that donut's probably about like 4 or 5 inches high.
Yeah.
That's super duper high when you put it on the head.
I'm sure.
Like 4 inches or so from the top. People go, oh, their hair was like a yard long. It's like, well, gravity. But 4 or 5 inches, 6 inches is huge when you, I'm sorry, I'm hitting the mic. It's huge when you compare it to the shape of your face.
Right.
So when Lauren and I were working on our book and we were working on proportions, we were actually starting to do stuff about hair in the book. That was the original table of contents. We had information about hair. It didn't make it into this book because we just physically don't have room.
Yeah.
But when we were starting to break down the proportions, we actually realized that half of the face is usually what was on top.
Okay.
So, you know, and that's usually going to be about like 4 to 6 inches or so, depending on how much of a long face you have,
right?
How tall you are, things like that. So it creates a lot of volume, but yeah, the donut thing, bring that up and down into it, pinning it around. I have been able to get some crazy, crazy tall hair that way that looks completely accurate to the period.
Yeah.
And actually very simple to do. I've been able to do those really tall hairstyles in as little as 20 minutes start to finish.
Nice.
So another thing is people go, oh, doesn't that take like hours to do? It's like, not if you know what you're doing.
Right.
You know, is it going to be the cleanest finish?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, but it's possible. It's not as complicated as what people think.
Nice.
So yeah. And then they change over time too. So like that donut shape, the swimmy. You don't see that basically after 1778 or so. And then it goes into more, like, you still have, we'll see rollers, but another one, the one with the feathers coming out of it, I call it the grub because it kind of looks like a grub. That one you see is really good shape for like the early 1780s.
Yeah.
Because it's rounded and full.
Nice.
But not a donut shape on top of your head. Things like that, yeah.
All right. Well, that's the end of this segment. We're going to come back and continue talking about some of this hair stuff, and then we'll bring in some of the more present things that you're doing, and then we'll talk about that. And awesome. We'll do all that in just a minute. Back in a second.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Okay, we're back. And man, as with a number of our shows and our guests, we could just go on for hours about all this stuff, but we're going to try to wrap it up in this segment. But I think we've got at least one more podcast planned with Abby and Lauren. So,
hey, we're right here, man.
I know, right here in Reno. So come on and record anytime. But so let's talk a little bit more about the hair care stuff, because you do have a lot of stuff in here. But you mentioned the cleanliness of hair, which, you know, we think of 18th century life and we see mud in the streets and we see all these things. And how could they possibly have been clean? What about keeping some of the like pests and things like that, you know, like we talked before about lice and fleas and stuff out of their hair. How do they do that in that environment?
Yeah, I think that's something that's really hard for us to wrap our brains around as modern people, because, you know, we have plumbing and sewage and I mean, like, they had some of that depending on where you lived to some degree, right? But still, disease was a problem. Cleanliness was a problem. Obviously, animal feces all over the streets, things like that too. It's a problem, and you want to stay clean. And like I said, hygiene was very important in the 18th century. You wanted to look clean and tidy. That's why white linens were always and having a lot of lace and nice textiles. You wanted to keep that clean and tidy, wearing white aprons or white caps or white ruffles. And you keep those clean, which is very hard to do. Even if you're not a dirty person, just naturally, eventually it gets kind of grody. You want to stay as clean as possible. That was really important. So the idea that people would be so focused on trying to stay as clean as possible and wearing clean shifts and shirts every day and changing their shirts and underwear and their shifts every day. Shirts and shifts are your underwear in the 18th century. But then not caring about their hair and just being like, yeah, everyone had bugs in their hair and like vermin and da-da-da-da-da. And like I was telling you earlier, you know, I've had people come up to me and go, well, they had like rats in their hair and that's why they had rat tail combs. And it's like, can we just take a step back from that real fast? Can we unpack that? Because so there's something called logic. And that is just what? Like, could you? It dumbfounds me. So one of the things I wanted to prove when I started going down this hairdressing route was, can I stay clean with 18th century hair care? If I use 18th century hair care the way they tell me to do it, will I get fleas? Will I get ticks? Well, obviously, ticks had nothing to do with this because living in Tidewater, Virginia, I did. there's nothing I could do about it. But, you know, or lice or anything like that, like lice and fleas and vermin and whatnot. And so I did actually live almost a whole year treating my hair the 18th century way. And I only washed my hair if I was visiting my grandmother or if I had a really like hardcore workout session at the gym and I was like super sweaty. I just did not want to deal with my grandmother being like, what's wrong with your hair? Why does it look like that? What are you doing? Are you insane?
It's easier just to not work out too.
Yeah. That too, but I was trying to be healthy at that point in time in my life. so I would go, you know, months without washing my hair in the modern way, because I wanted to see what would happen. And your hair does actually stay really clean when you use a pomade and powder. It smells fresh. And so whenever I started to get like gamey, for lack of a better term, I would pomade and powder my hair and do a fresh coat. It would take all the smell away. It would leave my hair and my scalp feeling nice and fresh and clean. I never got fleas. and I never got lice.
Nice.
Ever.
Yeah.
And I honestly, like, full disclosure, I was not a very good 18th century woman when it came to that. Like, I was really bad about combing my hair every day. Like, I never did.
Yeah.
You know, I would go like 2 weeks without pomading and powdering my hair. Like, I really like pushed the limits of like 18th century hygiene well. And I never had a problem. No one ever went, you stink, your hair is gross. Like, everyone was, it smelled fine. And like I said, if it ever started to, I thought it started to stink, like, I would take care of it. And then I started looking because, you know, I have a dog. I've always had dogs. And trying to deal with fleas and ticks, especially in Virginia, which was in the 18th century, a tropical climate. And here in Reno, it's great because it's like they don't exist, right? It's magical. I don't even know what to do with myself. But yeah, in Virginia, it's a massive problem. And so looking at seeing like, okay, well, what options do we have? And and so I turned the bottle of my dog's natural flea and tick repellent around and I look and I read the ingredients. And clove oil is like the main ingredient. Well, guess what's in my pomade?
Right.
Clove oil. And lemon oil. And those are common scents in the 18th century for hair care products. They really liked spicy scents like clove and cinnamon and mace and things like that. And lemony scents and citrusy scents. So like orange and lemon. On top of florals too, like lavender and rose and whatnot. Right. I just can't do those heavy florals because they give me headaches. I like the spicy, citrusy scents. And I was like, wait a damn minute. I was like, here we are, like, talking about, like, oh, do people have lice in their hair? Do people have fleas in their hair and vermin? They're literally putting natural flea repellent in their hair all the time.
Right.
And whether they realized it or not, that's what they were doing. So I went and looked in, like, homeowner books or, you know, housewifery books. That's the word I'm looking for, not homeowner, but housewifery books.
Yeah.
About, like, how to, like, deter pests because they had those recipes and like, here's what you do if you have a pest problem to get rid of them. And while I couldn't find clove being used specifically, you know, I saw things like lemongrass and, you know, all these other herbs. So it wasn't like they weren't aware of it. They were completely aware of it. So one of the things I would love to find is that smoking gun when it comes to my research is like clove oil, flea deterrent, pest deterrent. Haven't found it yet in a primary document, but we know that it works because we use it still today.
Right. We're just not sure if they were conscious of that's what it was also doing.
Yeah. And I think they had to be because they were aware that other herbs and spices and scents were doing it. And some people are like, well, maybe they just knew and so they didn't bother to write about it, which is completely valid. I don't want to think that way. I want to find that, that information, but yeah, it totally works. And so you have natural flea and tick repellent in your hair. And, another thing with the lice doing my research, I don't know why we as modern people, maybe it's like those who never had to deal with lice or they don't have kids who have to deal with lice. They assume that lice means you're dirty and that your hair is dirty, where it's actually the opposite. Lice is attracted to clean hair. So, you know, if you're putting pomade and powder into your hair and starch and your hair is dirty, quotes, the lice and larvae, they don't have anything to like attach to. So it actually works that way pretty well, too. And of course, people did get fleas and people did get lice.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, like, we had a flea problem in our house one summer because it was just so bad in Virginia. There was nothing you could do about it.
Yeah.
Like, we just waged war against them as best as we could. So it's not like we were dirty, like showered every day. It had nothing to do with it. It had to do with the fact that our dog went and played around in the grass and then came inside. Like, you know, it was just the fact of life. And it was awful. And I never want to do it again. but it had nothing to do with our personal hygiene.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty cool to find that connection just one day, looking at the back of a flea and tick repellent bottle. It's like, wait a damn minute here. So yeah, I think, the idea that their hygiene was gross or bad or wrong, I think that's just us imposing our modern views onto the past, which I don't like to do.
Yeah.
Because frankly, we do a lot of dumb stuff too.
Right. Yeah, I think I kept myself naturally lice repellent. I never had lice as a kid, neither did my brother. But we grew up in Washington State where we were pretty much covered in mud all the time because we played outside. It was raining. We're in the woods.
Yeah. I never had lice as a kid either. And I swear it's because I hated washing my hair.
Nice.
I was that kid when I was little. I never washed my hair. It was really gross.
Nice. So what are some of the, and I just want to go over this briefly so we can get on to some of the stuff you're doing now, but what are some of the things that you brought here? We've talked about it a little bit, but more specifically, I'm interested and we'll have, I'll take some pictures of this stuff and put it up.
You can also smell this stuff if you want to, because they have scents. I have a tin of my common pomade, pomatum. This is, sheep's tallow and pig's fat. And then it's scented with
Clove. That smells good.
Yeah. You can put some on your hand. It'll just rub right into your skin because it's animal fat. So it blends with our chemistry really well. So it won't be greasy or anything.
Nice.
And yeah, so that's scented with clove and lemon oil.
I love that smell too.
Yeah. A lot of people say it smells like Christmas.
It really does. I was actually going to say that.
And then my powder, it doesn't have as much of a strong scent. I think this one's probably the safest one to open. But you can.
Well, the studio is going to smell great now.
Yeah, there's a light floral scent with that.
Okay.
Because with hair powder, a common ingredient is ground up orris root, which is the root of the iris plant. So it has a slightly like yellowy.
Smells like a bouquet of flowers.
Yellowy color, but it does have a very mild floral scent as well. And now it's all over the studio.
That's perfect.
And I thought I was opening up the safe one. So a very light floral scent, but you do see other like really heavily scented ones with like rose water and orange blossoms and whatnot.
Okay.
The other big tin one, which could be scary to open. This one's the same as that one.
Oh, this one.
That one. That's the brown powder. That one was an experiment that didn't go terribly well.
I'll research. I'll look at it.
Be careful.
The studio can only smell better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm worried about the painter's pigment.
There we go.
I don't know what that one's. Does it smell like anything?
Yeah. What is that? Here. I think I smell lemon a little bit, actually, but I'm not sure what else is the dominant smell.
I think as there is like clove and cinnamon. I think I did actually put spice in this one. It also has umber in it, so painter's pigment, which is why I was like, be careful.
Right.
I made the mistake of experimenting with putting this on pomaded hair, and guess what I made? I made paint.
Nice.
So we learned that that colored powder goes over already pre-powdered hair.
Nice.
Yeah, it smells like a hippie grocery store. I think because, there's like cinnamon and clove in it as well. Maybe some lemon too. I don't know. But it does smell much better than I thought it would.
It smells like a few aisles at Whole Foods.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah,
Nice. All right, cool.
Yeah. Well,
and then these crazy hair things. I just can't imagine walking around with that on my head.
Oh, it's not bad. Oh, one of the cool things is my biggest challenge was figuring out hairpins.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the reasons why I went to using wool knits.
Okay.
They're actually pretty light. If you pick them up, they're not heavy.
Yeah.
Especially like some of the wool ones can be a little bit heavier and depending on how big they are, but you have to be able to jab a hairpin into the cushion to secure it to your head. And so the closest thing I found to 18th century hairpins today are actually Amish hairpins, which are steel wire, and they have a slightly sharpened tip, but not as much as what they did in the 18th century. And the hairpins in the 18th century, from what little I've been able to study, because a lot of them don't exist because they were just metal wire.
Yeah.
So by the way, if you're ever doing any digs and you find something that's just a bent piece of wire that's like super long, please let me know because it might be a hairpin.
Right.
Look at this trash, throw it away.
Yeah.
No!
Yeah.
They could be huge, like several inches long or very, very short. But Amish hairpins are the closest thing I've been able to find.
Okay. And this kind of looks like, for the listeners, it kind of looks like a long, probably inch and a half long, narrow staple almost is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because people go, well, we don't have them. They don't exist. It's
right.
In my mind, I look at them and I go, well, if you're going through a dig and you find a bit of wire that kind of looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know necessarily when it came from.
No, not at all.
What purpose it served.
I never would have thought
hairpin.
It could
be trash.
Yeah.
Like, but instead it might be like the mystery hairpin.
That's great to know. We find bits of wire all the time on sites because wire is so versatile in itself, you know, because they use it to like fasten things, especially on like old mine sites here in Nevada.
Yeah.
Now, there weren't a lot of, I don't know about early 20th century and late 19th century men working out at these mining sites. But early on, these mines were mostly men.
Yeah.
When they became more prosperous and they could bring their families out and do some things, then there was more women. And in those situations, we'd probably find more, because I don't know what men were doing with their hair 100 years ago or 150 years ago here.
The hair was pretty short.
Oh, yeah.
So probably. Yeah, it would be the women. Because
yeah.
hairpins, honestly, you can still, like I said, these are Amish hairpins.
Yeah.
But if you go to like Sally's Beauty Supply and you buy hairpins, It's the same basic U-shape.
For sure.
It's just whether or not they have a rubber plastic coating on the ends to make it more comfortable, which is not what I want for 18th century hairdressing, or just the quality of the wire.
Okay.
They're basically the same. So whether it's the 18th century or the 19th century or, you know, the 21st century, hairpins pretty much look the same. It's just their size and the quality of the wire that change.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, in the last 5 or 6 minutes here.
Yes.
So, you know, you mentioned when you got out of college in your undergrad, and it was like 2008 and a horrible time to look for a job for anyone.
Yeah.
So you went to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're probably, for people who are interested in vintage clothing and things like that, probably not a lot of career choices to begin with that are not in like theater and reenactments and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you happen to land what sounds like kind of the perfect job.
I have been extremely fortunate. Yes.
Right.
I will say, like, to get where I am now, which is vice president of American Dentist Shoes, I never thought I'd be in this position. I never thought I'd be sitting here talking to you as vice president of American Dentist Shoes in Reno, Nevada, of all places. But yeah, when I got into the field was still very, very fresh.
Yeah.
And honestly, not very well respected. Even today, especially when you're dealing with like some historians, not all, or like art historians, they don't necessarily consider clothing a valid point of research, which obviously I don't agree with.
That's weird.
And then, like with museums and things, they might have a clothing collection, but they might not have someone who's actually dedicated to being the clothing and textile curator.
Right.
So I really tried to prep myself by getting a very assorted skill set that would make me desirable when it comes to getting hired. And laying that groundwork is actually what got me where I am today. You know, my focus was to get work at Colonial Williamsburg because that is the mecca for, especially if you're an 18th century dress historian.
For sure.
Like, that's where you want to go.
Yeah.
Because they're doing work there that doesn't really exist anywhere else. And so it's extremely important work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with how life changes and things like that, I actually ended up meeting Lauren, my boss. I don't know if you know this. We met on blogs. Bloggers. Yeah.
Nice.
So a lot of like frustrated like dress historians and like costume historians and like costumers were like venting all of this like desire and frustration on blogs in the early 2000s. And it's still huge. It's a huge community today.
Yeah.
Changing. Most of them now are like on Instagram, but the whole like blogging community is huge. And so Lauren and I actually met as bloggers. I had a blog and she had her blog, American Duchess, and we became internet friends.
Mm-hmm.
And one day we were talking and about her business and her shoes. And, you know, I made this kind of like flippant comment about how, you know, like, ha ha ha, and in 5 years or so I can come and work for you. And it was this kind of like, well, why don't you just come now? And she said, you know, and what she tells people and when she's flattering me and making me embarrassed, you know, that I came in with such a weird skill set, but that it's perfect for what our business needs.
Yeah.
And that she was so excited that I, you know, that was even a possibility. And so, so yeah, I made it work. But for kids today and like people in universities today and going to school, like there are dress history programs all over the place now. And I get kids messaging me all the time. I'm sure of those who are listening to me, I'll get emails going, what university should I go to? I'm like, I don't know. Because like when I was in school, like I didn't have the options that they had.
Right.
You know, even now, my decorative arts and design history program at University of Glasgow is now a dress history program.
Yeah.
That happened 2 years after I graduated. You know, it's like, well, thanks, guys.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, so there's programs popping up all over the world that focus on dress history and are teaching students how to study dress history from that academic perspective and breaking it down, not just like this is what they wore back then from like a costumer perspective, but actually like as a social history.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's totally changing and it's so popular. Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, I want to do dress history. I want to do dress history. I'm like, there's no money. There's no jobs.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your enthusiasm, but there's like no work.
Nice.
Oh my gosh, guys. Please learn Photoshop so that way in Excel so that way you guys have more skills.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we tell people that all the time. Diversify. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the interest of time, I think we're going to try to get when Lauren has the time and you have the time, we can get you both in the studio. We're going to talk a lot about American Duchess, because that's all historical footwear. But then the kind of spinoff company, Royal Vintage Shoes, as well.
Sister company,
which we're going to talk about. Briefly mention, what do you guys, this is all footwear for both of these companies. So what do you guys sell for those?
Okay, so American Dutch's Shoes, we focus on historically accurate reproduction footwear from the basically 16th century, so the 1500s, Renaissance era, all the way up to 1920.
Okay.
And anything in between. So 18th century shoes, Regency style shoes, Civil War era, Edwardian boots. We're pretty sure we're the only manufacturer of actual functioning button boots for women.
Nice.
That you have to use a button hook to put on.
Yeah.
There's no hidden zippers or anything like that.
Yeah.
So we have, that's what we do as American Dutchess. And we're expanding. We have patterns out with Simplicity. Mm-hmm. We have another pattern coming out actually around Christmas time that coincides with our book that's coming out next month, which is crazy. And we talked about the book earlier about 18th century dressmaking. And using,
we're going to end with that, actually, a little more detail.
Okay. And coinciding with that. So we're expanding our brand. We also have a podcast, which is one of the reasons like you and I got to talking.
There you go.
We have a podcast too, focused on dress history and fashion history. Yeah. And so we're expanding the American Dutchess brand in a few different ways. But our main product that we sell are shoes, and historically accurate women's shoes. We don't sell men's shoes. Royal Vintage is the vintage side of everything. So shoes from the 1920s all the way up to about 1950. Again, women only. But we're having a good time working on reproducing really cool women's shoes from those decades. We have three collections out now. Our fall winter collection just arrived in our warehouse. We called it the New Yorker collection because it's super practical.
Nice.
With the idea, we were inspired by our friends in New York who walk all the time and they need good vintage shoes that they can walk in, not just peep-toed pumps that look pretty but are not functional for a life in New York. And yeah, so we're working on our, Lauren's actually in China right now working on the, in our workshops trying to get, the details figured out for our fall collection next year. So we're already like, it's like crazy.
Nice. Fashion. Well, we'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes, the American Dutchess website and the Royal Vintage Shoes website. Mm-hmm. I don't know who does your guys' photography, but it's beautiful. It looks
Lauren
really cool.
Actually does it, as does her husband, Chris. And sometimes I do it too. So it's another skill set I'm learning, but it's all in-house. We don't.
Whoever the people you're photographing and then the stuff they're wearing to go along with the shoes. I mean, it all looks really good. So check out the websites.
Yeah, we do a lot of sewing for that reason too, for the photo shoots and everything. So,
and that's a good segue because we'll end, we started with dresses and we'll end with dresses.
Yay,
so the book
close.
You guys have that's in like pre-order right now.
Yes.
And it will be available soon. This podcast, you could be listening to this in 2 years. So just look at the show notes.
We'll have
a link and go find it. So, but tell us a little bit about the book.
So Lauren was offered the book summer of 2016, right? No, it's 15. Oh my gosh. I don't remember anymore. Holy crap.
2 years 16, ago.
16.
Yeah. Okay, so, last year.
Last year. But it was before, it was after I had agreed to work for her. So I'd already signed my contract, but I was still actually at my old job. Mm. And she had been approached by this publishing company about writing a book because it seems like this publishing company looks at popular blogs and then approaches the bloggers to see about writing a book.
Nice.
And so obviously with Lauren's numbers for American Dutchess, huge numbers, great following. We have a strong social media presence, blah, blah, blah.
For sure.
So they approached and we started working on a table of contents and it kind of just started to evolve into an 18th century dress book. Because that's Lauren's passion is also 18th century dress. That's her favorite era too.
Nice.
And obviously that's my area of expertise.
Yeah.
And so we started working on this book a year ago. We had like 4 or 5 months to write this and everything's hand sewn. And we have, I think, over 50 projects in the book. I'm still recovering. and so we broke it down trying to figure out how costumers, beginner and advanced costumers and reenactors and living historians would want an 18th century dressmaking book.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created basically entire outfits. So we have like a 1740s outfit, a late 1760s outfit, a 1780s outfit, and a 1790s outfit. Each outfit is a different style of gown, a different fabric, and then all sorts of different accessories to go with it. So that way you can basically create your own wardrobe. But we also have basic photos of like how to get dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get asked that all the time. How do I put all this stuff on?
Right.
What order does it go in? So we took care of that too. You know, we talk about, well, what fabric should you use? Like, what do we recommend? What we don't recommend? Like cabbage roses from big box fabric stores. Don't use those to make your 18th century gowns. That's not correct. So we really tried to make a book that was accessible, interesting, informative, researched, footnoted, but consumable. And so we did it, we hope. We have one copy in our office right now. We're super excited about it. And yeah, it's going to be the publishing date's basically a month from now.
Which
is bananas. So Black Friday, essentially.
Okay.
End of November.
End of November.
And we'll see where it goes. But yeah, we created something that we don't think is really out there on the market.
Yeah.
Yet, and we're probably really excited about it. Yeah.
Excellent. So, well, sounds good.
I guess I should probably tell you what the book is called.
Oh yeah, yeah. Give us the title. It'll be in the show notes. But give us the title.
I hate to see Lauren like Abby. You talked about the book for like 10 minutes and you never once said the title. I'm like, the title of the book is called "The American Duchess Guide to 18th Century Dressmaking: How to Hand Sew Georgian Gowns and Wear Them with Style."
That's awesome.
So, and you can find it on any bookstore.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
yeah.
Outstanding. Well. Thank you. That's about it, all the time we have for this show. As I said, I'm going to try to get Abby and Lauren on later.
Yeah. It'll be a hoot and a half if you get Lauren in here, too.
We'll get both of you in here. Yeah. We might have to make it a two-parter. Anyway, thanks a lot. And if you guys have any questions on anything, send them to me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, and I will get those on to Abby. And then check out, like I said, check out the links. You go to the American Duchess website, and we'll have links to the blog and podcast up there.
Awesome. Thank you.
And of course, the book, so you can pre-order if you're listening in semi-real time, or order it if this is sometime in the future, or, you know, whatever. So. Okay.
In like 20 years. It's still in print. I hope so.
That's right. So, all right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been super fun.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.